Hello, I'm Matthew Gwither, and welcome to this first podcast in a new series from Family Capital. It's apt that we started this new project with two members from one family, one of whom, the principal, founded a VC investment firm which now has over $4 billion under management and has invested in more than 250 companies. John Flint's a fascinating individual, one-time lawyer and member of the Watergate Special Prosecution Force. He moved into VC in 1984 and established his first fund under the Polaris banner in 1996. He swung deals with Jennifer Aniston to promote his Living Proof beauty brand and introduced the ultra-fashionable Skyr Icelandic yogurt to a delighted US population. And now, he's established his own family office to invest his own capital. And I've interviewed him with his daughter, Sarah Flint, who's a successful shoe designer in the luxury fashion world and whose footwear is favoured by none other than Meghan Markle. So, do have a listen as we discuss whether successful investment is down more to experience, nous, and gut instinct than data and spreadsheets. What have been the pair's biggest hits and misses, and the differences in family businesses and investing between Europe and the United States, where John and Sarah are based. John, if I may start with you. You and Terry Maguire set up one of the most successful diversified venture and growth funds anywhere, and now you're both replicating those skills in the family office that you set up with Terry. If you had to put your finger on one thing, what's made you such a good and successful investor?
Terry and I really have a wonderful 40-year-plus partnership. And I think we have one of the really important elements that makes a great partnership, and that is we complement each other's skills and weaknesses so well. I think the second reason, which influences a lot, you know, what we talk about, I think, today, is that most of the really successful people that I've known, whether it's been in medicine or law or education or even sports, most of those people have had great mentors. And Terry and I were really fortunate to have three truly great mentors in Bill Egan, Jean Deliage, and Craig Burr at a firm called Burr Egan Deliage, which was a spin out of TA Associates back in the 1970s. And Terry and I were there for 12 years before starting Polaris. And as an example, the investment strategy that you mentioned, which is diversified, we really learned from them. It's not focused on just biotech or technology or whatever. It's a strategy based on diversification by markets, which have primarily included life sciences, technology, and consumer, and also by stage, which has been from seed stage, just backing a couple or one entrepreneur literally or figuratively in a garage or laboratory through the early stages and then through growth as well.
One of the things that people always wonder in your world is what makes you kind of good at it? Because there's this sense, as we read recently in Sebastian Mallaby's brilliant book, The Power Law, that it seems to rely on gut instinct and personality rather than spreadsheets and data. I mean, have you ever met a sort of a 20-year-old, 25-year-old who you immediately know would be a good venture capitalist and you would give a fund to manage? Or does that gut instinct that you can only get really through experience, is that the most important thing?
I think, first of all, you mentioned, you know, a young person. I think I think there's a 10-year rule in almost anything. And I think it takes, you know, at least 10 years to get really good at something. I think you need the experience, you know, of having seen a lot of really good deals, a lot of mediocre deals, and a lot of awful deals to achieve good judgment. And then on top of that, as I said, I think you need mentorship. And I think that it's not just gut. I think that one, and this is one of the things that we learned from our mentors, one really needs to do significant due diligence on kind of the basics of what make a good business. And part of those, you know, one of the you know, sort of tried and true things, obviously, is you need to have good margins, both, you know, gross margins and pre-tax margins. You have to have, you've heard this over and over again, a sustainable competitive advantage, not just a competitive advantage at the moment, but one that can be sustained over a period of time. If you're a good long-term investor, you need to have something that's, you know, that's highly, you know, differentiated. Then you need to do your due diligence on the people as well and make sure that they have the qualities that, you know, one has seen demonstrated for successful companies. Where the gut comes in after you've done, you know, that hard work is determining whether or not an entrepreneur or a set of entrepreneurs have the leadership ability to take a company through the highs and lows that every early stage company or even later stage company experiences, and whether or not they have the ability to listen and be coached, and whether or not, if they're young and if they're not experienced managers, whether or not they will at the right time have the self-confidence to bring in a very experienced, successful manager to help them get to the next level.
I wonder how important failure is as well, that you learn as much from the things that you back that didn't work as you learn from backing the things that did.
It's a great question, because that's another characteristic of people who you're backing. And that is, in fact, one of the questions that we always ask entrepreneurs or executives who are hiring for our companies. And that is not only, you know, where have they been successful, but where have they failed and what have they learned from it?
That's something that's where I think there's still a profound difference between Europe and the States, isn't there? Where in America, you almost wear failures in business as a badge of pride, whereas here, if someone has sort of failed at something, there's this almost a sort of a stigma attached with it.
In entrepreneurial culture, failure is not necessarily a band of shame. In fact, you know, one of my biggest successes was a company where the entrepreneur came to us for an investment. We turned him down. He got investment from some very famous venture guys and failed. And then he came back to us with another idea and we backed him and he did great.
What about investing in people that you actually didn't like, that you didn't feel that you could rub along with?
Never done it. Never would.
That's interesting. So you feel that a sense of fellow feeling and sympathy in individuals and the fact that you would be able to go out with a beer with them or something is an important part of your world.
Not so much whether or not I felt like, you know, they would be friends of mine who, you know, I ended up going on vacation with or out for a beer, you know, or beer would be different. You know, you do that with lots of entrepreneurs. But I think there have been deals where I was pretty convinced they were going to be a success, but where I thought the entrepreneur was extraordinarily arrogant, you know, had sort of that stereotypical Silicon Valley arrogance, wouldn't necessarily listen or be coached, and just felt that I wouldn't be listened to and it probably wouldn't be fun. And these are we invest assuming that these are going to be long-term relationships. We're not in this to make a quick buck. Most of our companies we're investors in for anywhere from the shortest amount, 3 years to, you know, 10 years or more. And the average is probably 8. And so, you know, life's too short. We've all learned in the last 2 years to be partners with somebody who you...
Well, look, tell us more about Polaris Founders Capital, your family office, and how's its outlook, how's its investment strategy different from Polaris Partners?
We always knew that if we were successful, we'd want that firm to continue beyond us, and that we would, you know, give a chance to the younger partners who we'd been mentoring to take over and have their own fund. We didn't want them to do what we did and leave Polaris and go start another one. Although if they wanted to, we wouldn't object to that. And there have been Polaris partners who have left Polaris and started their own firms. And we've backed them, in fact, you know, very successfully. So in our sixth fund, we brought in four of the younger partners who we had mentored into the management company. And then we handed them what I've called the joys of managing by stepping away from the management of the company. So, you know, by our seventh fund, we had grown to over 60 people in Boston and San Francisco and New York. But we didn't want to retire. So we formed Polaris Founders Capital that has enabled us and given us much more flexibility in how we invest our capital and how we spend our time. Terry, in particular, as I indicated, is actively investing in biotech deals through both Polaris Partners, the original fund, and through Polaris Founders Capital. Though I'm not investing the new Polaris Partners funds, I've invested a substantial amount into those funds, and I'm investing in a wide variety with Terry, a range of companies in various markets and stages through our family office fund, Polaris Founders Capital.
Now, tell me about Icelandic yogurt. Although I'm familiar with skin, most people are not. So tell me how you came about that one.
In our first Polaris fund, almost 20 years ago, Terry backed a Harvard genomics professor who was himself Icelandic, brilliant guy who, in fact, looks like a Viking. And his idea was because there were only, at that time, I think 320,000 Icelanders, he could more easily identify various genomic anomalies and come up with various therapeutics, various drugs. And so we backed him in a company in Iceland. And because we were going to Iceland to visit that company, we even had one of our investors' limited partner meetings in Iceland. We fell in love with the country. We took our families there on vacation. And like you, one of the things we fell in love with was skier. And the thing that was great about skier is, as you know, is that it was and is very high in protein, low in sugar, deliciously creamy. And we didn't have anything like that in the United States. And we love to work out. You know, one of the things you want to do when you work out is you want to eat protein, both before and certainly after you do so. And that's what we were using skier for. And it took us a while, but we convinced them to become partners with us in Icelandic provisions to provide these, not just skier, but eventually our goal is to provide a whole range of products of Icelandic dairy and food products in the United States.
We know now more than ever there's enormous family wealth out there right across the globe, and they're playing a not always very high profile, but a significant role in business globally at the moment. So how do you see this relationship developing?
Historically, of course, family offices like the Rockefellers helped start the venture industry. You know, really until I would say it, 5 to 10 years ago, most family offices were investing in venture funds as limited partners. But then as a result of what you talked about, you know, given all the wealth that's been generated in recent generations here in the United States, certainly by technology and life sciences, I think, the growth of family offices establishing their own venture firms can be explained by that. And I think it will continue.
They're very frequently discreet, aren't they? I mean, that's family capital's great job in life, to find out what's going on there. But the very nature of the fact that they're private, they're not on public markets, means they can go about their business frequently quite quietly, can't they?
Yes, which is an advantage sometimes. I think the primary benefit is that you have flexibility, you know, without having institutional limited partners as investors. You can follow, you know, strategies that you want to follow. You don't have to. I think there is a pressure by institutional limited partners to be more focused, to just focus on. I think there are fewer diversified venture capital firms now. Most venture firms are either biotech firms or they're technology firms or consumer firms. They're either seed or early or growth. And as a family office, you can, you know, play it all in all those markets or any of those markets that you want to.
What are the advantages of that then, that you haven't got people in media scrabbling around finding out what's going on, but you can just keep your heads down and keep focused on the knitting?
I think it's that flexibility. For example, both Terry and I have started companies, you know, even at Polaris, you know, on our own, and which not every venture capitalist has done. At the main Polaris fund, as an example, I started a high-tech beauty company, of all things, called Living Proof, with Bob Langer, who is at MIT, who is the largest laboratory at MIT, one of the largest in the world. He's one of the founders of Moderna. Ran that for a while when couldn't find the right CEO, and hired Jennifer Aniston to be our spokesperson, which skyrocketed the sales. And but I had to go back to running Polaris, and we were also in it for a while. So because we had institutional limited partners, we had to sell it to Unilever. And being in a family office allows us the flexibility to hold companies for a long time if we want to. I mean, Icelandic Provisions, as an example, we may want to hold that for 20 years, or we may want to sell it earlier. We now have the flexibility that we can do that. We have the flexibility to back Sarah, as an example, which we, you know, that could not have done if we were in an institutionally backed limited partnership.
But how have you found your attitudes change then from Polaris Partners to going to Polaris Founders Capital, your own family offices? What have been the kind of pluses for you in being able to sit there with your own capital and decide yourself how to invest it?
In today's Polaris, which is doing primarily biotech and life sciences with some health-related kinds of things and a few tech deals, we couldn't have invested in the two spirits companies. We invested, as I mentioned earlier, in a gin company and a mezcal company. We can go into it, but the spirits industry is really interesting because the multiples that people pay for spirits companies are very high.
Well, Sarah, look, let's bring you in here. You very patiently sat and listened. Tell us, what was conversation over the kitchen table like at the Flint household when you were kids?
You know, I always tell people when they ask me, why did you decide to do this so early? I think it was just that. It was that I grew up at the kitchen table talking about the young entrepreneurs that my dad was working with and sort of their successes and failures. And it was so thrilling and exciting to me that I just sort of felt like, oh, well, that's what you want to do.
Tell us the path you embarked on then. So you from high school, you went to art college, is that right?
I did, yes. I went to FIT in New York to study accessories design. And then I actually moved to Italy to study manufacturing. So went to a school to work alongside factory workers and really understand the engineering that goes into shoe design. And the reason that I did that was that I was always obsessed with art and fashion and sketching. But the real niche that I saw in the market was to create luxury shoes that were still beautiful and artisanal and fashionable, but actually fit and felt good and were comfortable.
But not for men, Sarah. Why not for guys?
You know what? Men just don't buy as many shoes, unfortunately.
You want to come and see how many I've got? I'm like Imelda Marcos.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the way to go. But it's been an interesting path. We started originally, I thought, okay, I'm selling top luxury shoes. There's only one way to do that. You have to get into the prestige department stores. And we did. We got into Barney's New York, which was kind of the holy grail for new designers in New York. Did that for a couple years and sold at eventually Bloomingdale's and Mode Operandi and Shopop and all of these great places, including specialty stores across the country, but kind of looked at the way that the world was changing from a consumer perspective and the fact that there were more and more direct consumer brands that were exploding and offering, you know, an incredible product, but avoiding the challenges that go with being a wholesale business. And I think that as I started talking to one of my biggest mentors, my father, about all of the challenges we were seeing, you know, in wholesale, the fact that you don't control your margin, your markdown cadence, you don't have, most importantly, you don't have access to your customer data, or your customer insights. I think he encouraged me early on to not be afraid to sort of make a change and pivot the business. And in 2017, we pivoted the business to move to direct consumer. So we completely dropped all of our wholesale accounts, started doing pop-up stores and selling mostly online, dropping our prices, still producing at the same unbelievable manufacturers in Italy that produce for the top luxury brands, but going directly to that consumer. And it was a risky move. I had to get buy-in from my investors, not just my father, but other investors, our board, but essentially dropped. You know, our business was like 20% direct to consumer at that point. And that year we had projected the business to grow 100%. And I thought, oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? I'm not sure, but we're going to make it happen. And we ended up from 2017 to 2018, we grew over 200%.
You made the right decision there, didn't you? And, you know, what fortuitous timing just before 2020 and all those shops being shut.
Exactly. It was really, really lucky. And I have, you know, a lot of friends within the industry that were not so lucky, that had orders canceled and, you know, no real direct line to their customer and way to reach them. And we have an unbelievably loyal customer base. So we continued to do well during the pandemic and expand categories and grow.
I think one of the things that startles outside observers with the fashion world and direct to consumer is the astonishingly high rate of returns. And I've known people who told me that, you know, it's up to sort of 40% often. But is that just something you have to live with? Is that about right for your business?
We see that, particularly, you know, in a shoe business for first-time buyers. We find that when customers become familiar with the brand, they are much better, and we have a much lower return rate than 40% for sure. I believe there are certain categories that are higher. For example, dresses and swimwear are quite high. But we also have pop-up shops, which help a lot. And we've worked on sort of integrating things onto our website like True Fit that help customers understand sort of sizing. But first and foremost, you really just have to build that into your margin. It's sort of the price of doing business. You have to understand that you're going to have those returns.
So to go back to when you were growing up, did you feel encouraged by your parents to go into commerce, to go into business? And I mean, your dad started out as a lawyer, didn't he? And it's the classic thing is that people in commerce always want their kids to be lawyers or accountants or, you know, doctors or something like that. But frequently it moves in the other direction towards the profession. So how were you being influenced subtly or otherwise by your parents as a child?
Yeah, so I actually had a fair amount of learning disabilities growing up, and my dad did as well. And one of the things he sort of always said to me was like, you know, work hard, do well in, you know, what you're good at, but don't worry about the things that you're not good at. Those are the, you know, the areas that you can get help on, which has definitely been a philosophy. I think he mentioned his relationship with Terry and how they sort of complement each other's strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, I think I was able to see how successful he had been despite having those learning disabilities. And, you know, while I don't know if he originally, we'll have to ask him, thought he should be a lawyer or really wanted to be a lawyer, but there was never kind of pressure of, okay, well, don't go to art school. You should go to, you know, get a liberal arts degree or something like that. I think my parents always just felt that I should do, you know, what I was passionate about and what made me happy. And I was not only always sort of interested in business, but also incredibly creatively inclined and painting and drawing. And it was the area that made me the happiest.
How good do you think you'd be at his job and vice versa?
He won't admit it, but he's pretty creative, actually. His mother was an artist and was a huge inspiration to me, actually, and incredibly fashionable. And we have artwork in our house that he has done. But, you know, I think I would say we would both be pretty good at each other's jobs, I think. You know, the finance and math side for me, no. But I think that from the standpoint of understanding, you know, entrepreneurs and what makes them tick and young businesses and the pitfalls, I've seen a lot at this point.
But how about Sarah then, if she'd been doing your job, if her rather than you had set up with Terry, what qualities do you think she's got that might have made her a success in that?
Sarah is relentless. She's very, very competitive as well, which you wouldn't expect in an artist. This is a very competitive business, as you know. Her people skills are excellent, and her common sense business judgment is very good. And I think that's, you know, something I didn't mention earlier. And I think that's another thing that distinguishes most very successful venture guys is they have very good common sense business judgment. And, you know, I can remember Sarah when she was you know, young, in her teens. We'd be driving along and she would ask me a question about one of the companies I was involved with. And I'd kind of look over at her and go, where did that come from? Because it was so insightful.
So I'm going to ask both of you your best ever business decision and the worst ever business decisions that you've made during the course of your careers thus far. So let's start with you, Sarah. What was the best single thing that you have decided to do in your career?
That move to direct-to-consumer, really, and taking control of our narrative. The challenges with wholesale were so great, and I was really saddling myself to a business that was declining, and it just felt so freeing to be able to suddenly retake that. And I think probably the worst decisions, or one of the worst decisions, I think something my dad has always said, but it took me a little bit to learn despite that, would be, you know, when you know something's not working with an employee, not letting them go fast enough, and trying to make it work for, you know, for longer than it should, because you just waste time. And I think one of the most valuable things I've learned in the years of Sarah Flint is that you just have to be not only relentless and competitive, but you have to be incredibly fast and willing to try things, have them not work, and try something new.
Best decision was a personal decision. You mentioned that I was a lawyer. I was a young litigator, first in New York and then in Boston, and I really didn't like it. And I had worked in government before that and had seen some really, really brilliant litigators, and I didn't think I could match them. And I just didn't think it was right for me. But I worked for the main venture capital law firm on the East Coast, which was in Boston. And I was seeing what venture guys were doing. And to me, that looked like more fun and more closely aligned with what my skill set was. What I talked about earlier, which was identify and attract really good people, that they were really in the people collecting business as a big part of what they did. I had somehow managed in my earlier young life to associate with some very, very successful kind of well-known people. And so I took that pitch to a bunch of venture guys, probably 20. They all looked at me cross-eyed. They all said, wait a second, you didn't go to MIT. You didn't go to Harvard. You don't have an electrical engineering degree from MIT or Stanford. You don't have an MBA degree. You didn't work for IBM. Why would we hire you? And then this guy, Bill Egan, liked my background. He liked my pitch, but he didn't have a job for me. And so I went to him the day after he said no. And I said, look, I just had my first daughter, who is not Sarah. Sarah's one of four, number three and four. And I said, I have 9 months of cash. I'll work for you for free for 6 months, figuring I could get a job in three. And that's what he did. And that worked out.
Good work. And the worst decision?
I've made mistakes and failures, but as you insightfully said earlier, you learn from those. I think the worst decisions didn't have to do with investing in a specific company. It had to do with holding on to them too long.
I'm going to ask you both a final couple of questions. I think here in Europe, we're very conscious that the US has got the most mature and hugely successful market for venture capital. And in Europe, we kind of haven't matched it. But then some of us would say, well, during pandemic, the Pfizer thing came from the States, but from Oxford, we got the AstraZeneca one. What do you think is happening in Europe at the moment that they haven't been able to scale those companies that have grown at such extraordinary pace as they have in the States in the last 30 years? But first you, John, and then you, Sarah.
The venture industry, we've certainly seen, has grown in Europe, and there have been some successes, and European governments are clearly trying to help. For example, the Irish government invested in Polaris, the main funds, and helped us set up an incubator in Dublin. But obviously, the venture industry is much smaller there. And I'm sure there have been studies done by European governments and universities that could give you a lot more, you know, good data on that than I could. But if I could offer one personal observation, it's pretty simple. comes down to people once again. There simply are not as many entrepreneurs in Europe as in the US, nor is there the infrastructure of universities. And that infrastructure is really important, the infrastructure of, you know, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, and others that are incubators for entrepreneurship. And then you have all the associated other aspects of infrastructure, law firms and accounting firms and consulting firms and headhunters, that that's really hard to replicate.
Now, Sarah, it's an interesting question for you, because that's one of the things probably that in Europe we have done pretty well, in Italy and in France, in, you know, that highly competitive luxury sector. You've had those companies very frequently family-owned and run that have become hugely successful globally. So what is it? I mean, is it simply a matter of heritage that sort of Europe goes back further, that whole kind of provenance thing? What do you think it is, the difference between Europe and the States there with brands?
Yeah, I think in the luxury sector, while there are new brands that come up, they usually do come from families that are within the industry. So it's very unusual. I remember when I was first starting out and the factory owners would ask me, you know, what my parents did. Were they in manufacturing? Were they in this type of a business? So I think it's a little bit more acceptable over there, but really still within families that have come from this. And I was just thinking, Matthew, I wonder if the difference as well comes down to overall venture capital landscape. You mentioned that there's, you know, more of a stigma around failure in Europe. I think that venture capital is a highly risky industry. So maybe there's just less of a risk tolerance.
But tell me, Sarah, if in a couple of years' time you got the call up from the head of LVMH to sell to them, would you do that? Or do you want to hang on to it and pass it on down to your family?
I want to create a really big brand that has longevity and gets a good return for my investors. So if that's selling to someone in a few years, that's going to help me achieve both of those things, I would absolutely do it. You know, my benefit is that I'm the designer and my name is on the door, so I'm not going anywhere with a sale. So it's a good place to be.
So there you have it. A fascinating father-daughter combo who learn important things from each other despite their very different business leadership roles. I'm Matthew Guiver, and hope to meet you again on Family Capital soon. Thank you for listening.